This is February 5th, 2018. It is the first day of this wonderful, 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 wonderful beginning of session. And we're only going to go for, it's our short session, and we're only going to go for 35 days.
Less.
Now, today, 34.
So are we done then now?
you wish. I am opening up an informational meeting of, and it's the Criminal Justice Commission, and it's an update on 2017 legislation. And I know that we've got Mike Schmidt, the executive director. Mike, who is there with you?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. I am joined at the table by Kelly Officer, one of our senior analysts, research analysts, and she is going to kick off our presentation today. But before I turn it over to Kelly, I just wanted to, well, I have this opportunity to update this committee. I did want to touch on one topic, which is the federal burn JAG dollars that are in the CJC budget. Probably most or all of you are aware, the state of Oregon and the CJC specifically received a letter from US DOJ asking us to produce documents about our compliance with federal immigration. So we are looking through that right now and looking at our state policies and complying. What I want to let this committee know about is that we have not yet received our 2017 federal burn JAG grant dollars. Typically, we would receive those in the fall of the year of 2017 for the 17 JAG. So although we had budgeted off of receiving that federal those federal grants like we have every year for a while past now, we have not received those this biennium, and so that is starting to be felt within our agency and within our plans, because we obviously are working on projects that those funds implicate, and one of those projects is the Justice Reinvestment Summit, for example.
Mr. Schmidt, we have a new member, and so hopefully, and he probably is not accustomed to some of our alphabet soup yet. He might, but just in case, it might be well to know that we do have a new member on this panel. I think that's the, well, maybe, is the co-chair new?
Co-chair.
So just keep that in mind, if you would. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. So the federal burn JAG, or the Justice Assistant Grants, you're probably familiar from your time working in the Portland Police Bureau, because Portland is a recipient of that grant fund. So CJC has, as of yet, not received the 2017 grants. And we use that for many projects. It's a big source of funding for our specialty courts. It's also one of the areas that we can use funding to do innovative things in the state around criminal justice. And one of those things is our Justice Reinvestment Summit, which we have been putting on every 2 years for the last couple biennium. And it's really an amazing opportunity for everybody in the state to get together. I think most of you have been able to attend at least part of one of those summits, where we can all discuss statewide justice reinvestment, what's working, learn from our other counties, learn from each other, bring in speakers from across the country to kind of educate us on evidence-based policies and practices that we can then hopefully bring back into our communities. So I just wanted to kind of tee this up to you all today, because we are in the process of planning for those types of projects. And the money that we would have received from the 2017 federal burn JAG grants was what was going to pay for those things. But unfortunately, until the federal government releases those funds, that kind of puts us in a tough position as we are both trying to plan a year out and putting down payments on venues and starting to book out people to come and travel and things like that. It's really creating a tough situation for us on planning for the rest of our biennium. I'll just note that no jurisdiction across the country has received their 2017 federal burn JAG grant. So it's not just Oregon, although Oregon was specifically one of the 23 jurisdictions that was sent out a letter requesting additional documentation. But nobody across the country has received these grants. So we are starting to hear from other jurisdictions across the country that similarly rely on those federal dollars to support law enforcement projects and public safety projects across the state, that is really starting to be to have an impact. So I wanted to just take this opportunity that I'm in front of you to tee up that as an issue, because you may be hearing more about that from me as we move on and start coming up on some of these dates that we would be otherwise be looking to spend those dollars. So on that cheery note, I will now turn it over to Kelly Officer. Kelly is probably, I think, has the distinction of being the longest standing staff member at the Criminal Justice Commission. Most of you probably have worked with Kelly or asked for data. And if you ask me for data, I just turn around and ask Kelly for data, and then I'd send it to you. But so folks from all across the state know Kelly because she does a lot of the analysis and does a lot of the facts and figures out what is happening across the state. Today, Kelly is going to talk to you all about our prison forecast. And she can answer background questions. We are not the agency in charge of doing the forecast, and she'll talk about that, but yet we have a big part in helping with that analysis. And specifically, we were asked for this presentation to talk to you all about the impacts of House Bill 3078 on the prison forecast and why it is we saw the changes and movements that were forecasted into this. So with that introduction, I'll turn it over to Kelly.
Thanks, Mike. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Officer. I'm a research analyst with the Criminal Justice Commission, and thank you, Mike, for the introduction. So as Mike said, we're going to talk about House Bill 3078 and the impact to the prison forecast from that legislation. So just a little bit of background. So the prison population forecast is produced by the Office of Economic Analysis, which is within DAS, Department of Administrative Services, and they release the forecast twice a year, October 1st and April 1st. And then our agency does the bed savings or estimated increases of proposed legislation. So we are doing the analysis during the legislative session to estimate bed impacts, and that's worked into the fiscal analysis process. And then when it's time to do the forecast, we give that information to the Office of Economic Analysis so that they can incorporate it into the forecast. I will say the forecast done by the Office of Economic Analysis, it has several assumptions that goes into that forecast. So they take into account overall prison population growth within the state over a 10-year period. And they also project out prison intakes over those 10 years and how long those intakes are projected to stay into the system. So they have kind of a complex forecast model to have people, you know, coming in, staying for their sentence, and phasing out, and then estimating the overall population over time. And then when there's a law change that is estimated to impact that prison forecast, then we provide the information of the impacts we did so that they can incorporate that into the forecast. So for today, we want to go over the bed impacts for House Bill 3078, which was passed last session and has an impact to the prison population forecast. 3078 does these four major sentencing changes, and we'll go through each one in detail. But the four kind of sections of 3078 is the first one was to expand the short-term transleave program from 90 days to 120 days, and then to remove the crimes of ID theft and theft one from Measure 57 sentencing. It expanded the FSAP program, or Family Sentencing Alternative Program, and also establishes a downward departure program, which was a Justice Reinvestment Supplemental Funding Program that was funded at $7 million for this biennium. So to start with, we'll start with the short-term transleave program. So we're assuming about 100 participants a month into this program. That's what's currently happened with the 90-day program. In fact, in 2017, the average number of participants in the short-term transleave program was about 113 a month. So they're just above the estimate. We're still assuming 100 participants a month. We're assuming the same folks participate same program qualification criteria, but that they participate for a maximum of 120 days instead of 90 days. So we're assuming that counties have all the resources they need to have participants in that program for a longer period of time, including housing, treatment, and programming. And this part of the bill is not effective. It is effective for sentences on or after January 1, 2018. So it's just starting to come online. So as folks come in to start their prison sentence starting on January 1 and after, they would participate in this program at the end of the sentence. So it's going to have some phase-in time for these bed savings to come online, and we work that into the estimate. A possible risk to this estimate is that any change in sentencing practices around short-term translation.
Excuse me.
Oh, question?
Yes, Representative.
Well, I am, which prison are we talking about, or which prisoners are we talking about for this?
Sure. I'm supposed to say co-chairs and members of the committee. we did the estimate for the total prison population, and we also broke that out by male and female. So, you know, the short-term translead program has both male and female participants, and this change is estimated to impact both in a similar way. So when we did that estimate, we said, okay, here's how many female participants, and here's how many male participants, and then with this change, here's our estimated savings for the male population and the female population. So for the female population, any changes will just impact the one prison, female prison facility, Coffee Creek. And then for the males, they have more facilities. And so how that impacts certain prisons on the male side is kind of up to DOC and their capacity management planning.
Thank you.
Yep. So a possible risk is any change in sentencing practices around short-term transleave eligibility. So when people come into the prison system, the sentencing judgment will indicate which programs are eligible for. So short-term transleave, just like any other programming, can indicate whether they're eligible or not coming into the system for those folks to be eligible. And then we also want to let you know that we just updated our short-term transleave recidivism analysis report. This is brand new. We just finished it last week. So the link there is at the bottom to the report on our website. This is the report where we were able to look at three-year recidivism outcomes for those who have participated in short-term transleave and then those who have not participated but were statutorily eligible for the program. So we updated those three-year rates, and those who've participated in the program have lower recidivism rates than those who have not participated. And that continued the trend that we saw for the one-year and two-year recidivism rate. So the statewide definition of recidivism in Oregon is a three-year rate, so this was our first opportunity to look at that three-year rate within that report. So far, it's looking like those participating have a lower recidivism rate than those who do not participate.
Which is what we were hoping for.
Right, right.
It's unexpected. Really?
Yes. Okay, so the next section is the identity theft and theft one changes. So Measure 57 makes more property prison cases prison eligible and also shows a higher length of stay for the property prison intakes. And so the changes in House Bill 3078 remove two crimes, ID theft and theft one, from Measure 57 sentencing. So we looked at a couple years when Measure 57 was not in effect, 2008 and 2011, and then compared that to years when it was in effect to estimate the bed savings of the change. So a possible risk is any changes in sentencing practices for those two specific crimes in those years. And another possible risk is the Foote versus State lawsuit. This is a current pending lawsuit regarding whether House Bill 3078 is constitutional. This is really a risk to the entire bill, but we have it in this section because this is the section of the bill that specifically changes Measure 57.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. So this may not be the right time to ask this question. If it's not, I'll postpone it. Are we getting hesitancy from counties to participate in the changes that we mandated by law, not to put too fine a point on it, because of the Foote lawsuit?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair and Senator Steiner-Hayward, we are hearing that different counties are approaching the legislation in different ways. Some are taking the position they don't think that it's constitutional. They agree with the Foote lawsuit, and they are potentially looking at how they do plea agreements and other things to account for that. So Yes, I think different counties are approaching it different ways. Some counties are, I think probably the majority of counties are just going with the law change and the sentencing changes. But there certainly are some counties that we're hearing from practitioners that's not happening. And I'll just note as a side note that today, actually, probably as we speak in Clackamas County right now, that lawsuit is being heard. The hearing is happening right now on both the criminal and civil side of that suit.
You want to follow?
More of a comment than a question. I'm just very disappointed by this lawsuit, and I think it was very well vetted during the 2017 session. We got a lot of legal opinion to reassure us that it was, in fact, constitutional, and I'm sorry Mr. Foote has decided to pursue this because it's hampering our efforts to achieve our true goals in the criminal justice system, which is to decrease crime and help more people be productive members of society, which I think the vast majority of the people on this committee and in the legislature agreed that bill would do. So it's not your fault, but if there are things the legislature needs to do to help in that regard, then you'll let us know, I assume.
Well, I was not surprised. So having worked on the committee in 2013 and going through that with the other three co-chairs and actually knowing where some, not all, DAs are, Foote is consistent. So that did not surprise me with the action that DA Foote took. But I do have a question, and that is whether or not the concern of some counties with respect to the $7 million, that, is that tied to this issue as well?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we did initially, when the suit was filed, receive some questions from some counties about what the risk would be around spending those funds. The concern was twofold. One, that CJC, if the DA was to prevail and the bill was struck down as being unconstitutional, would CJC claw back any funds that were already sent out to the counties, since there would no longer be the statutory authority to have sent the funds? So that was question one, is would we claw back? And question two was, would we send out the remainder of the funds? Because as a grant administering agency, we don't like to send out all the money right away at the beginning. We like to do it 1 year at a time so that we can check in with the counties and see how the programs are working. And it's our normal grant administrative process. So both of those were concerns of counties. I've had, and Ross can talk about this a little bit later when he gets to his section of the presentation, Ross Caldwell, who does a lot of the justice reinvestment work around the state. I've asked that we've check in with all of 12 of the counties who are receiving grants, and I believe that all 12 are going forward, that they are hiring, that they are spending the money, and that they are building these programs. So it looks like they are all acting as if, you know, they have the money and pursuant to the grant programs and agreements at this time.
That's good to hear. I, as the individual who worked very hard to get those extra dollars, in the previous session, I was troubled, and you know, we had our conversation about it, but that they were going to tie this with the action of Foote. And then also I'd received some communication from the good DA, with some concerns about how the dollars were being allocated and what have you. So, you know, the extra dollars and looking at justice reinvestment, it was to make certain that they were going based on what we expected them to do. You know, this whole notion that you just, from the state level, we continue to send out dollars without results is not something that I'm sure that most of us say we can't continue as a practice. And so, you know, I commend, you know, the CJC and the work that was done in order to make certain that we were not only sending the dollars out, but the instructions that was sent to the recipients as to the expectations. If we're not getting the results that we, you know, had hoped for, then we won't continue, at least this legislator will not continue to go up the hill to try to get those extra dollars to send to the counties. And I'm saying this, and I hope they're listening, because the dollars are scarce, and so it's not where I've got a tree outside that you can go out and just pick money off the tree and say, here, county. The other piece of it is that taxpayers expect some results from what we're doing. And so I'm very pleased that they're going forward with this. So that's about all of my bully pulpit that I'll do for today.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. The changes for ID theft and theft one are effective for sentences on or after January 1, 2018. So again, some lead-in time for these changes to start to have an effect in terms of bed savings that were estimated for that. Next is the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, or the FSAP program. So just as a reminder, this is a program that Department of Corrections and DHS jointly run in 5 counties, and the qualification criteria was expanded for this to allow more participants to enter. And so that was to allow participants who have a previous conviction for a person or sex crime. Those who are currently being sentenced for a person or sex crime are not eligible. It also allows women who are pregnant at the time of sentencing to be eligible, and eligibility for the program can be a mitigating factor at sentencing. And then finally, we have the downward departure programs, or the prison diversion program. So for our estimate of the prison savings for this program, we assume there would be 10% fewer property intakes for the participating counties, and that those intakes would have an average length of stay of about 21 months. We assumed that 11 counties would participate, and there were actually 12 counties who've received funding for the program. And then the 10% fewer prison intakes, we looked at Marion and Lane counties and when they started their 416 program, which is a prison diversion program. And so looking at the combination of those two counties, we did see the 10% drop in their prison intakes from when they started that program. So we did have kind of an example to look at for those. This is also starts. We are assuming that the program would start beginning January 1, 2018. For the counties that have received the funding, many of them are funding positions, and so they have to hire new staff. If it's a new program for them, they need to get it up and running, work out the kinks, troubleshoot any issues. Some counties are expanding current programs, but they have to kind of build that capacity to build that in. I will also say about our estimate that we did, when the counties applied for these funds, they had to have a plan as to what their program was going to look like and how they were going to get it up and running, what it was going to operate like. And within that, we asked them for their estimate of how many intakes they thought they could save in terms of doing this program. And for some of those counties, those estimates were much higher than what we did with our 10% assumption, which I think is great in terms of their planning and getting those programs up and running. But for what we have given to the Office of Economic Analysis to put into the prison forecast is what we think is a more conservative estimate of these programs. So if the counties are actually reaching some of those higher number goals that they set for themselves, we can revisit this estimate as the forecast is done twice a year and revise that if needed. But for now, we think we have a more conservative estimate of these programs in the bill. And so here's a graph to just show the bed savings estimates overall. This is for the female population specifically. So the blue bar is the savings at the end of this current biennium, so by July 1, 2019. And then the orange bar is the 10-year estimate. So, many of these were effective starting January 1, so there's some buildup time for those to take to get to kind of their full bed savings. Several years it will take for some of them. And so you can see that it will take some time for those to come online. Also, you'll see that ID theft is zero for the end of this first biennium. And that's because when we looked at females for the crime of identity theft, when we looked at those comparison years of 2008 and 2011, the intakes really weren't that different, but it was the length of stay where we were seeing the prison savings for that. So if we're getting the prison savings on the length of stay, it's going to take longer for that to phase in. As opposed to theft one, we saw both a savings on intakes and length of stay. So the impact is a little larger, and it comes online a little quicker for theft one, for females specifically. And then here's the same graph for the male estimate. So again, the blue bars kind of show by the end of this biennium. And again, there's some of that buildup time for that to come online. And then the total impact at 10 years for the male population. And then again, we have that more conservative estimate for the downward departure program. And so now we'll show the most recent version of the prison population and forecast. So this is the female prison population forecast. Many of you will recognize this graph. This is the most recent of this. So that red line is at 1,280 female inmates. So the one institution for females, Coffee Creek, has a capacity of 1,280 female inmates. This green line is the forecast in April 2013. So this was the forecast before justice reinvestment was passed in the 2013 session. So you can see that additional capacity would have been needed by 2014 for the female population. This is what has actually happened with the female population to date. So you can see we've got about a year and a half of being above that 1280 capacity line. The population peaked recently, October 1st and November 1st in 2017, at 1319 female inmates, which is about 40 beds above that 1280 capacity line. And then February 1st, it dropped a little bit to 1287 was the female population at that time. Here is the April 2017 forecast. So this was the forecast during the 2017 session that doesn't have any of the law changes in 2017 because those had not passed at that time. This is what we call the DOC funded forecast. So this was the forecast that was used during the session. So you can see that forecast, you know, it has a fairly flat female population over the 10-year period, pretty minimal growth within that, but it's also consistently above that 1280 capacity line, anywhere from 20 to 40 beds for the female population. And so 20 to 40 beds doesn't sound like a lot, but to be consistently above it for that period of time is, an uncomfortable management plan, I think, for the female population. So that's what it looked like in April 2017. And then here's the most recent forecast, the October 2017 forecast, which has incorporated the estimated savings of 3078. So it does take some time for those changes to come online. It's not immediate. And so you can see that blue line will peak. That's June 1st, 2018. That blue line will peak at 1,325 female inmates and then drops from there. So by July 1, 2019, it's at 1,278. And then from there, it drops fairly steadily until 2022 at about 1,180. And you can see it's fairly flat from that point on. So we will be tracking all the changes of House Bill 3078 and tracking this forecast to see if what we have estimated to occur actually occurs. We have the same thing for the male population as well. So here's the... here's the capacity line for Junction City for the male population. This is at 14,020 male inmates. So this requires new prison construction for the Junction City facility for the male population. And so again, this green line is the April 2013 forecast before justice reinvestment passed. You can see pretty steady growth within that. And Junction City would have been needed to be ready to go in 2017 is what was estimated to happen. And then here's what's actually happened with the male population. So when justice reinvestment passed in 2013, it's fairly flat, some ups and downs within there. February 1st, it did tick up slightly. There you can see that last little peak up on the black line is 13,513 male inmates. Here's the April 2017 forecast, which was, again, that DOC-funded forecast during the session. And that does have some steady growth on the male population, but you can see that the rate of that growth is slower than what was projected prior to justice reinvestment. And it does stay below that Junction City capacity line, although at the 10-year mark, it gets close.
Senator. Thank you. So why do you project that kind of sort of jaggedy increase over the next years. My mm-hmm. eyes are too small, too bad to read all the little dates on there, and I'm not looking at it on my screen, whereas it's been flat, basically, for the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. Why are you now projecting this increase?
Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, the Office of Economic Analysis does the forecast, and they do kind of have some of these ups and downs or seasonal adjustments. We do uh-huh. see seasonality within that prison population. And that April 2013 forecast had pretty steady growth with the underlying assumptions of prison population growth and prison intakes coming in. So 3194, flatlined that, but it wasn't projected to flatline that for 10 years. It flatlined that for as long as it took for those estimates to come online, and then the underlying growth within the forecast eventually does come back into play. So we do still have growth coming into the mail forecast, even with House Bill 3194 fully in effect. I don't know if that answers the question.
But that doesn't take into consideration the legislation that we passed in 2017. That's
exactly.
Okay.
Right. Yes.
Got
yes. It. This is.
I just want to make sure
this
I was yes. understanding. Sure. Okay. Good.
Yeah. No. Thank you for
just
that clarification.
To
yeah.
Clarify.
Yeah. So this is the April 2017 forecast. It does not account for the changes in the 2017 session. Yeah. Is this orange line here? Thanks. Sorry. You good? Okay. And then here, but here, the blue line is the October 2017 forecast that does have the estimated savings of House Bill 3078 incorporated within it. So again, it takes some time for those changes to come online, and you'll see that blue line will peak June 1st, 2018 at about 13,650 male inmates, and then it drops fairly steadily until 2022. And so you can see that blue line is also well below that Junction City capacity, and also, at a larger magnitude than the April 2017 forecast was. So, the April line, even though it stayed below the Junction City capacity, still got fairly close at the 10-year mark, and the October 2017 forecast is much lower than that and does not come close to that Junction City threshold for the October okay. 2017 forecast.
I should have just looked ahead.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay,
good?
Questions?
So I guess we'll conclude with any questions. Good.
Nice work.
Thank you very much.
All right, next up on the hot seat
is John.
So John Fitzgerald, you will all recall, of course, Senate Bill 1041 asked the CJC to both study the where our money goes in the state for alcohol and drug treatment, and then also what outcomes we receive in return for that. So that legislation created a temporary position at the CJC to do this work. We're extremely fortunate to bring John on at the, I believe, end of October. He started with the CJC. And so since his time beginning, he's really kind of hit the ground running and meeting with everybody and trying to wrap our head around that funding and that budgetary issue, which is a lot of the information he'll share with you today. And then we are beginning to start thinking about the outcomes. So I'll let John introduce himself and take you through his presentation.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. John Fitzgerald. I'm a policy analyst with the Criminal Justice Commission. And what I'd like to do is, as Mike said, I started at the very end of October. So I've been on this about 3 months. And so I'd like to give you kind of an overview of what I've learned so far during that time period. For those of you, just a quick overview of Senate Bill 1041. It's essentially a tracking of all public money appropriated and expended for the provision of alcohol and drug treatment in Oregon. And at the same time, it's also looking at the outcomes for that spend. So it's those two pieces of tracking money and what are the outcomes. It also includes having the agencies of OHA, DHS, DOC, and OIA work with CJC on this. And at this time, I've met with all of those agencies, and I will say that they've all been very, very cooperative up to this point. I wanted to start off by saying that this is a report that I just recently became aware of, and I just got a hold of it this last Friday, but it's about 10 years old. The analysis of Oregon's drug and alcohol treatment system and prevention system, it was done by the Human Services Research Institute, And in some ways, it's about a 120-page report, but it very, very closely parallels what you're asking in Senate Bill 1041. It tracks all the public money. It looks at outcomes. It does a gaps analysis. So it serves as a very nice baseline and template for what we're doing right now. There are a number of policy recommendations that already in the meetings that I've had, I can suggest that are going to be similar in SB 1041, some of these things. I wanted to make you aware of it as a baseline as we go forward.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
So do we have any sense of whether any of the recommendations in that particular report were actually implemented? Of course, the timing is terrible. Well, December 2008, I mean, the height of the recession. So,
yeah. Some of the recommendations I can say are such as targeting 18 to 25-year-olds. That still continues to be a target population. But I'm not far enough into this to see have we really gone and targeted that population in any way. But I will most definitely look at the recommendations and make sure I have an answer for those for you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I will say at the get-go is that I know right now as I present some of these numbers that without context, without being able to look at these numbers in relation to other spends and also really look at these numbers in terms of the number of patients being treated, that it won't have as much meaning. I recognize that, but that will be coming in the report as this work evolves. So right now, part of the work over the last 3 months has been meeting with all of the budget analysts for the departments that were listed in the Senate bill and asking them for their budgets. All of them are 17-19 biennium, except for DOC, which was 15-17. And so you can see that the total spend on alcohol and drug treatment is roughly around $340 million.
John, this doesn't include county, though, right?
That's right. It doesn't. Yeah, and I'll talk about that.
And, yes.
Yeah.
And that's general fund?
Yeah.
Or total
yes.
funds?
Right there.
Thank you.
Yep. So that's a bit more of a detailed analysis. The non-Medicaid are really the block grants. The Medicaid funding, which really is the funding that goes to the CCOs. And then from the CCOs, it flows into the counties. And some counties are actual providers of treatment, and other counties will pass on that money to providers in their communities. You'll see that the public health spend is quite small compared to the others, and this is a more detailed analysis of the non-Medicaid spend. One of the things that's just interesting, I think, is if you look at the other funds limited, we fund a significant amount of addiction treatment through revenues that we collect from objects of addiction, marijuana, alcohol, gambling. It's kind of an interesting piece of how we look at it. You'll also see in there the SAMHSA opioid special grant of about $13 million that's looking at funding some projects for addressing the opioid epidemic in Oregon. This is a bit looking at the non-Medicaid spend based on service elements, which is essentially how OHA puts together their budget. And you can take a look that at the very top, residential day capacity, the opioid crisis, A&D residential. One of the things that I'm hoping to do is, and I think it would have more meaning as we look at the financial data, is to really be able to look at it based on levels of care, so that as we're looking at funding, how much goes to detox, to residential, to intensive outpatient, to outpatient, and even more, being able to look at the transitions between care, because we know that if people go into detox and they don't get into residential, that is money that's not well spent.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
The number to the left of each line, like 67 residential day capacity, is that the number of beds or the number of facilities?
Sorry, neither. It's the service element. I should have clarified.
Okay.
Sorry.
I appreciate that.
Yes.
And so I should look ahead because you may be getting there. since I'm really good at asking the next question. But I don't see it, so I'm going to ask. We're spending $14 million, for example, on residential day capacity, and that's to treat how many people? Like, I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand.
And that's my point at the beginning, is we don't have that yet. We have we've started creating interagency agreements so that we can get data to start connecting the dots between how much is spent and where treatment is occurring, how many people are getting treatment. So that will be coming.
Because this is really the challenging question, right? I mean, it may be worth it to spend more per person in a particular context if we have a higher likelihood of long-term abstinence, right, and long-term recovery, then it may make sense to invest more up front. On the other hand, if it seems treatment plan indifferent, the outcomes, then I'm not totally convinced that it makes sense to, you know, we got to think really hard about how we focus the use of our dollars, which was part of the point of this bill. So,
yes, agreed.
To me, it's, you know, and this is our first blush and getting started. And John, we met because, you know, as you know, we had none of the answers when, you know, we introduced the bill. You know, we knew that we just had some alcohol and drug treatment. We didn't know how much. We didn't know where. We didn't know, you know, who's on first, who's on second. We had no real look at any outcome. So this begins our first, and thank you, John, our first blush at trying to get some information and some data. And I'm sure that somewhere in here is going to tell us where the bed usage, when we get further along, whether women and men and diversity and some of those other, by the time we get through drilling down.
Absolutely. And I will tell you that those numbers and those answers are in the 2008 report. So if you want to look at a baseline and have a sense of what that looks like, you could look at that, and that will give you some sense of where we're headed for this update.
Could you provide Julie with a link wherever you find that, and then make it easier so we don't have to search?
Yes,
thank
absolutely.
You. I'm lazy. Or overworked, one of the two.
Yep, okay.
I'll take the overworked.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
So this is an overview of the Medicaid spending for the CCOs, a little over $200 million. This also, I think, is a slide that illustrates how this is a changing environment. Some of you are aware that family care is going to be absorbed. I know HealthShare is working on taking many of those patients, but it's illustrative of, as I meet with various people and agencies, that some of this is a moving target and that dollars are moving around and that things are changing. But one of the things that we're going to want to do absolutely is reach out to the CCOs and find out what sort of data they have in terms of outcomes. We will be doing some analysis with the Medicaid data set to try to link up number of patients, the types of treatment that they've been getting, levels of care with these spends.
You know, when I first began this interest in this legislation, and I know somewhere we've got to get to bed capacity, because the question that I've had is, what is the bed capacity across the state, both from a standpoint of detox, residential, and what have you in it, because I had a situation where I had an individual and that had detoxed, but there was no bed for residential. You know, there, and so when I was doing drug courts and some of the others, so those issues came up. So we set and in policy these what we consider evidence-based programs, and then find that they may or may not have the resources out there in the community to actually do what we're asking them to do. So that was a bed capacity and what exists ultimately, I'm hoping, will be in.
And Senator Winters, we will, I think, try to get at the bed capacity as we reach out to levels of care. And at the same time, I think part of your question is, you know, how are we appropriating funds across levels of care? One of the recent analyses that was done between residential and intensive outpatient was that for most people, the outcomes are about the same, but intensive outpatient comes at a fraction of the cost.
This is my point. Yeah.
And so I think this is one of the things that hopefully the story that we tell in this report will motivate you all to be able to take this data and information and make some recommendations across the system in terms of how to improve it. This is just a brief summary of the public health prevention. I'm actually meeting with Tony Bigland tomorrow to talk with him. He's one of the state experts on prevention, to learn a little bit more about prevention. But from my understanding, part of tracking the outcomes of prevention get more challenging just because of, as you put out ads to different populations, trying to register how many people actually saw ads, and then how do you measure the outcome of how that leads to preventing people going down the path of addiction, is a bit challenging from my understanding. But I also think that as this study evolves, we'll try to get as best handle on prevention that we can. Moving to the Department of Corrections, DOC, this is a summary of their spend for the 15-17 biennium. It's split, it's about $20 million in total. About half is dedicated to people in prison. The other is for community treatment. This is...
And I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yes, Sandra.
That does not currently include medication-assisted treatment, right? Or does that come under the medical budget?
As far as I know, it does not include medication-assisted treatment.
Because we're not really providing MAT
in
corrections at this point.
Which is what some of us
think we ought to do.
We do.
Yes. Okay. And most of that treatment occurs in the last...
6 months.
6 months prior to release.
Yes.
So people come in addicted and don't get any specific treatment if they're in for 4 years. Mm-hmm. They don't get any treatment until their last six months.
Yeah, that's true. The other issue that we have is that within the prison, I toured it recently, mental health and addictions are two separate doors. So while we talk about co-occurring disorders and the fact that most people in prison have alcohol and drug as well as mental health issues, mm-hmm. I was quite shocked personally to get a tour and walk by the door that said behavioral health service and say, wait a minute, they're not connected, they don't share evaluations? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. So that is something that I really believe.
That's very problematic.
We need to try to fix.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representative Sanchez.
Thank you. Cascadia CCF, is that supposed to be?
Those are acronyms. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Well, I was just wondering, is it supposed to be Coffee Creek Correctional Facility? You're just missing a C?
Maybe.
So is that money is funding Cascadia to do services within those two facilities?
Yes, these are the programs that are getting those contracts to do treatment in prison.
In prison.
Yes.
Huh.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So, and as Senator Steiner Hayward said, the most of this treatment happens, end as people get out. And the other thing that I've heard is that often when people are released, they're released to be into communities where they're homeless, or there's simply not a level of treatment available for mm-hmm. them when they're released into the community.
Yep.
And that was one of the findings in 2008, and I think it'll probably continue to be a finding today.
It is. Trust me.
Yeah.
It is.
So this is based on the total spend by counties. And I think one of the things it illustrates is that the DOC funds that go to counties are not the entire amount of money that counties spend on those that come out of the criminal justice system. So counties get multiple sources of funding that will be used in community treatment. But it gives you some idea of the breakdown and that counties do spend very different amounts.
I just found it interesting that Multnomah County, the largest county, and how small it is.
That's my question, too.
I think it's paid differently, but I'm not positive.
I just found, looking at Multnomah County, which is our largest county,
yes.
and the dollar amount is in comparison to Clackamas, and maybe I ought to have a conversation with Clackamas, and Washington County, and of course, and Marion. Well, Marion gets more, but our population is, yes. Was there any explanation of that?
So, Madam Chair, I think, so counties are able to use different funding sources and different budgets. So what John is looking at is just the DOC money. So it's not to say that how much money Multnomah County spends on alcohol and drug treatment.
That's why I clarified earlier, the county dollars are not in here.
That's correct.
So, right. Madam Chair. Representative Sanchez.
Thank you. Do we have a breakdown of what that actually looks like, what that's actually being used for?
Not right now. I don't.
Okay.
No.
Can we get one?
Yes. Well, actually, I take that back. I have a spreadsheet that shows the specific substance abuse treatment programs that that these dollar amounts are funding. And so in the comprehensive spreadsheet I had, what I removed was any of the treatments such as sex offender treatment, anything that wasn't alcohol and drug. And so I do have, and in the report it will list the specific treatment programs and how much money they're receiving. What it does not list is the treatment based on what's the level of care, you know, what percentage of patients are receiving medication-assisted treatment, what are the specific treatments being used.
Yes, Senator Frederick.
Well, that was my next question. I'd like to know
numbers.
Well, I'd like to know numbers, but I'd like to know what treatments are being used. What are we doing? In my tour of the state prison last year, we came upon what was supposed to be a treatment room that was basically a chair that apparently you would be hooked to. And that, I mean, the treatment was, horrible. Yeah. If that was the treatment, that was not going to help the situation at all. I mean, I understood why it was set up that way, but the what are we doing exactly is a significant concern of mine. You know, what is there therapy involved? Is there, and if so, what kind of therapy and how effective is it? And has it been identified as something that's going to be effective? I'm not interested so much in the name of the agency or the name of the particular program. What are we doing?
Yes, Senator Frederick, I think it's a great question. I just recently toured one of the prisons here in Salem, and so I was able to observe one of the groups, and I asked for the treatment manual so that I could go through and look at what the curriculum was. And you know, I think throughout Oregon, one of the things that we talk a lot about is evidence-based practices and utilizing evidence-based practices. So on one hand, we can talk about levels of care. What you're talking about is much more granularity in terms of within residential treatment or intensive outpatient, within groups, what are the actual treatment strategies that we use? And I think it's a very good question. And we actually know a lot about the treatments being used. And so I can address some of that in the report. I could talk a lot about it right now, but I know that would take too much time. But I think it's a very, very fair question to ask, which is, what are the treatments? How do we know that they're working?
Follow-up.
And a good example would be medication-assisted treatment. So for opioid addiction, we know that the number one medication is methadone. The Cochrane Collaboration, a lot of other studies have shown that it is the most effective medication for the cost.
I would challenge you on that, quite frankly. I think we have an effort up at OHSU right now on Suboxone.
Absolutely.
That I think is probably has a better potential in terms of medication treatment. But I've got to say this as well. When I saw this last year when we did that tour, it was better than what I'd seen 4 years before.
Yep.
I didn't come running from the prison at that particular level. 4 years before, I still have nightmares about it, quite frankly. What I saw was a little better, at least some sense of humanity within that. And I'm very concerned. I think we need to find, I would love to see what you do come up with in terms of what the therapy, what the treatment is like, and how effective it is, and how the folks who are going through that treatment feel about what's being done there, and frankly, at the county level as well. Thank you,
Senator Frederick. Thank you. Thank you. Oregon Youth Authority. Right now, the total spend that I receive from them is under about $1 million. I know that when I looked at the 2008 report. There's a pretty big discrepancy, like $3 or $4 million, which I, I haven't explained yet. I'm not sure exactly why the funding was much more significant 10 years ago than it is now. But these numbers, I think, need to be investigated a bit more closely. But I just received these numbers last week. So I'll be looking more at OIA and sort of the differences.
Madam Chair?
Yes. So I'm sure the answer to this is yes. But at some point, you're also going to break it down by cost per individual, or in the case of the CCOs, cost per member per month over the entire population?
Yes, we can do that.
Okay.
Yeah, once we know how many people have been treated and we know the costs, hopefully with linking this data, we'll be able to do that. Yes.
I'm totally like doing all the data in my head. It's just, you know me. Put me in front of a big data spreadsheet and I'm a happy woman. But
and I actually, at the end of this, there is an analysis that sort of talks to what you're
saying.
Thank
you. So. And I want to apologize to you guys in advance. I actually am going to go testify on the opioid bill in just a minute. So I'm figuring you probably want me to do that, but I may miss part of your presentation.
All right. I'll continue on. I don't have too many more slides. The Criminal Justice Commission, behind OHA and DOC, we are the third largest funder of addiction treatment in Oregon, and we fund that through both our justice reinvestment and our specialty courts, both about $6 million. And this just gives you, again, a breakdown of where the money goes by county. One of the things that we're looking at is doing a survey at the county level because, as I've mentioned, the counties receive money from a variety of different sources. And so for us to have an accurate picture of how much money is being spent in Oregon, we're developing a template with Multnomah County and Marion counties to reach out to the other counties to really get an accounting of how much is being spent. I will tell you that this approach was also taken in 2008. They reached out to the counties and they heard back from, I think, 19 of the counties. And there were some complications in how they were, the counties provided that information. So we're going to look at how they did that and see if we can't get some better estimates and connect the dots between what was done then, reaching out to the counties and the work that we're going to do. We're also going to look at a variety of other agencies just to make sure that none of these other public agencies are putting any money into addiction treatment. And we are starting to do the initial work on outcomes. We met with the integrated client services folks from OHA to start conversations around setting up agreements so that we can share data between the different agencies, which will allow us to get at a lot of the questions that you're asking. We will be doing analyses with the Medicaid, the CCO data, the MOTS data, as well as other data sets to try to answer some of these questions that will link back to the spending. When thinking about the outcomes that we're looking at, we are going to definitely look at populations in need of treatment, those that are being served and the gaps, so there'll be a gap analysis. We're going to look at relapse measured by people returning to treatment, recidivism as it links to the criminal justice data, employment, housing. We're talking about some other outcomes as well. And I think I want to just kind of wrap this up with the idea that I think it's the gap analysis, looking at, again, what our current spend is, given what our current treatment system looks like, and what might we do to improve it. And so part of that will be really looking at, again, the populations in need and who's getting these services, the gaps between those, and really in some ways, how has that changed over the last decade? Just to give you kind of a preview, this is an updated report from what was actually in the 2008 report, and it's using national survey from drug use and health data, looking at Oregon's population. And there's a couple things I would just point out. If you look at any substance at the very bottom here, the 18 to 25, 16.83% of people needing but not receiving treatment at a specialty facility identified by the NHTSA data, that was identified in the 2015-16 data. That's the exact same finding from 10 years ago. If you look at 18 and over in Oregon, the people needing but not receiving treatment, over 300,000 people. Whew. And some of you may be aware of this was done in 2015 by Dale Jarvis and Associates. This was looking at Medicaid data. And this gets a bit more at, if you look at the total number that were included in this study, about 1 million people, and then looking at how many people had a substance use disorder, around 130,000. The members served, 44,700, provides us a gap, and the gap is around 66%. The gap that was identified overall in the 2008 report was around 75%. Again, I'm not sure that I would compare these yet, but the gap, needless to say, is significant.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. One question that I want us all to think about is this. We passed legislation in the state some years ago for mental health parity on commercial insurance. Most of us are unconvinced that that's actually happening. And in fact, we passed legislation last year, do not ask me to remember the bill number, that required DCBS to do a data call and try to actually figure out what was happening. I would point out that when people who have commercial jobs and commercial insurance have substance use disorders and aren't getting proper treatment for it, they are more likely to suddenly become unemployed and therefore be on state health care, funded health care. So there's an intersection, right? This is something of a Venn diagram, and the two inform each other. Conversely, if we give people the right treatment, they can turn around and potentially become productive citizens again and have jobs that pay them well enough that they don't need to be on Medicaid. So I hope that as part of this ongoing work, Mr. Fitzgerald, that you're having conversations with your colleagues at DCBS who are doing somewhat analogous work. So just to make sure that we're getting at that intersection.
Yes, thank you very much, Senator Steiner Haywood. Any final questions? This initial overview of SB 1041.
Thanks.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. John, thank you for a very comprehensive report, and you've had a short period of time to do this in, and you've got a lot done. And I really want to thank you for it. And I know that by the time you get the report completed, we'll probably go, ah.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
How are we going to go again?
All right. Last but certainly not least is Ross Caldwell. Ross is our Justice Reinvestment Liaison, so he is the gentleman that goes all over the state working with the counties, works on all of their projects, along with Madeline Dardot at our agency. The two of them do a lot of work together. They speak to a lot of different local public safety coordinating councils across the state. Help the counties kind of interact with our data, and especially around the goals of justice reinvestment. So we asked Ross to talk an update about justice reinvestment in general, because there were some our commission made some decisions this time that it hasn't made in the past, which is to award 32 counties full justice reinvestment grants, but four counties to give them one-year awards. So this is for the first time our commission is kind of looking at some of the counties that were not either hitting results and then did not give us plans that the commission felt would achieve the goals of justice reinvestment. So that's a change, and of course it goes probably without saying that you know, some people are
some people are not so happy.
Not so happy about that change. So Ross can talk a little bit about that and the reaction that he's seen, because he's also going out and now working with those local public safety coordinating councils. And then also to talk about the new grant program in House Bill 3078. So go ahead.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Ross Caldwell from the Criminal Justice Commission. So going to talk, as Mike said, about the Justice Reinvestment Grant Program, both the formula grant and the $7 million supplemental grant. So first we will talk about the formula grant. We're calling it the formula grant now because we actually have two justice reinvestment grants, and they're different for us to run. The formula grant, obviously, each county has a slice of the pie that's predetermined by the DOC grant and aid formula, so they know how much money they're going to get once funding is determined in each big year session. So I know most of you are very familiar with this, but we'll go over it again. We have the four goals of justice reinvestment, which are to reduce recidivism, to decrease prison utilization for the nonviolent property and drug offenders, at the same time to continue to protect public safety and to hold offenders accountable. So the basic idea, kind of in a nutshell, is that counties beef up their local public safety system with this grant money. And by, you know, when they do that, they can keep more of these nonviolent drug and property offenders locally on probation, and they can do that safely. If they don't send those people to prison, it saves the state money. The state can then reinvest a portion of that money in the counties, and we don't have to build a new prison in Junction City, which saves the state a very substantial amount of money. So this is the third biennium of justice reinvestment. In the first biennium, it was starting in 2013 when the legislation was passed. It was funded at $15 million, which when you spread it out between all 36 counties, doesn't go too far. And back then, the application process was just, do you want the money, yes or no? And everybody, not surprisingly, wanted the money. So those checks went out. And there was really no application process back then. In the next biennium, 15-17, there was an application process. And we asked the counties, what are you going to do with this money that's going to tie to the goals of justice reinvestment, reduce recidivism, use less prison, maintain public safety? And so we had a real kind of back and forth with the counties. We worked with them on their applications quite a bit because they hadn't had to do this before. Now here we are 2 years later, and it's the second go-round of an application process for the 17-19 biennium. So this time our goal was to make sure we kept tying this to the goals, and we also wanted to be more data-driven. So we had the counties look at recidivism data, prison use data, and reported crime data as part of their application process, and our questions were structured around that. So we wanted them to look forward with what they were going to continue to do with the money, but also to look back over the last few years and to see, what have we been doing with this money in our county, and are we reaching those goals? Are we reducing recidivism? You know, what's our prison use look like? And then what are we seeing in our reported crime data? Not all those data sets are equal. It's really good for us to get, really easy for us to get data from Department of Corrections, so we can tell who's going to prison, what they're going for, what county they're coming from. But recidivism data, you know, it takes 3 years to get. It takes time for that to change. And so we're just now getting to the point where some of the first people that went through the justice reinvestment programs, we're starting to get recidivism data on them just now. So that takes a while to phase in. And reported crime data, which we'll see in a second here, that also lags significantly. So we track this stuff as best we can, but it is complicated. So this is just an example of what counties had to look at. So this is Lane County, for example. So as part of their application, we asked them to look at this information and to respond to it. The next example is prison use. So this is Klamath County. And that kind of jagged blue line going all over the place there, that is Klamath County's prison use over time. So some months you go up, some months you go down. We wanted counties, when they're filling out their application, to look at those numbers and say, why did you go up in this time? Why did you go down in this time? We know that these graphs we put together are good at showing what happened, but they don't always tell you why things happened. So for example, we had, I think it was Jackson County, they had a pretty substantial spike about a year and a half ago where their prison use started to really creep up. And when they looked at our dashboards, they were able to tell that's right when we closed down a wing of our jail. And if you have a wing of your jail closed, you can't hold the people you need to hold pretrial. You can't adequately sanction people on probation. So it really kind of ties your hands as a local system. And the result of that, and kind of an immediate result, was that their prison use started to go up. They weren't giving as many downward departures, so people were going straight to prison instead of getting a shot at probation. And they were revoking people more quickly because they didn't have room in their jail to hold them for a sanction. So the alternatives were kind of, you know, you mess up on probation, or you pick up a new misdemeanor or something like that, we can't put you in jail because we don't have room. So we can either do nothing or we can send you to prison. And so more people were going to prison. So we kind of built this, and the reason we want the counties to look at it is to see how their local decisions are affecting their prison use. And it's just kind of a goal. The goal continues to be, look at how this is connecting up. You know, we can see that your decisions do play out in the numbers, and we want them to look at that and tell us what they're seeing. This is an example of reported crime data for Deschutes County. So this is another thing they looked at. This data does lag, so we get it about a year later, so it's not as immediate as something like prison use, but it's kind of the best we have for public safety. It's hard to measure public safety, obviously. All right, so the Grant Review Committee and our commissioners had four different options with county funding. So they could approve for two full years of funding for the biennium. They could give approval for provisional funding, and then we'll take a look at them in a year and see what changes they've made. They could give conditional approval, or they could reject entirely. And where we ended up with the $40 million formula grant, as Mike said, is we had 32 counties that received full two-year funding, and there's four counties that got the provisional funding. So we're going to get our grant review committee and our commissioners back together in late March or April to take a look at those counties and see how they've adjusted their plans. And Madeline and I are working with them extensively and going out and going to their LIPSIC meetings and continuing to follow up to see what changes they're making. And, I guess I should also say, when counties turn in their applications, it's not like you turn in your test and your test gets graded and you don't get a chance to adjust your answers. This is a very extensive back and forth process where we work with all the counties and, you know, we don't make the funding decisions. We have a grant review committee and a commission that does that. But we do have a chance to look at the county's applications, and because we kind of work, you know, with you all and then also with the counties, we can say, if you don't answer this question better, we think you're going to have a hard time getting funded. And so a big part of our role in the application process was kind of that back and forth with the counties and looking at drafts of their application and trying to get them to, you know, really look at the data and answer questions. So that was something that we spent a lot of time on. And in the same way, now that we have four counties with provisional funding, we're spending a lot of time working with them trying to kind of rehabilitate things so that they'll get into a good spot.
That was a shock to some counties.
It was.
But you did, because I received some communication from some counties, and I know that you did actually go out and meet and set and explain and work with those counties.
Yeah.
So thank you.
But Madam Chair,
yes.
I think it's the right thing.
It's absolutely the right thing.
Yeah.
It's what was expected, and I, you know, really commend the commission. And in fact, I think the work that they're doing can be a model for some of the other issues that we face.
Yes, ma'am.
With other agencies, because they're getting not. It's the whole issue is, what are the results? What are we doing, with the dollars that we are sending out, with the expectation that there will be some improvements. So anyway, I think, and I just commend the staff, two things. One, for working with those counties where there were problems, and I know that you do that. But also, two, whenever there seems to be a communication or something's out there, I know that the good Mike Schmidt calls me on the phone. And so the communication with us is also good, and I appreciate that, so that we're not blindsided by what's going on out there in the counties and what you're doing. And I thoroughly appreciate it, by the way.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, we do a lot of driving around, so if you hear anything about our travel budget at any point, please don't be hard on us. We're not wasting it. All right, so we won't go through all these individually, but we're seeing a lot of different types of programs. Some counties have multiple types of programs. Some counties only get a $100,000 minimum. So these are some of the things that we're seeing repeatedly. We have more counties that are working on their pretrial systems now. National Institute of Corrections came out to Oregon, did a pretrial training for, I think it was 8 or 9 counties, and some counties are starting to work that into their justice reinvestment programs. Some counties are beefing up their drug courts, so there's a lot of different things happening, and if you want to hear more about any of them specifically, we have some more information on our website, and we'd always be happy to tell you what we know. So how do the counties use the funds? The big breakdown, and this has changed a little bit from last biennium, is that of these three boxes, services, supervision and sanctions, and treatment, those each get more than 20%. So more than $8 million of that total $40 million are going into those three categories. And then the remainder are there at the bottom. So that's everything from, you know, mentoring, providing housing for people, helping them get jobs, treatment, mental health and addiction, be it drug or alcohol or both. And then providing more, some counties have real jail capacity issues. And if you're going to have more people on supervision, you got to be able to sanction them. And so jail beds and then alternative sanctions. And some counties need more positions. So kind of a variety of things out there. And one of the good things, one of the best things about this program is that counties can really decide what they want to do. So as long as they're meeting the goals of justice reinvestment, they have the freedom to put this into their system wherever they think they need it. So that's one of the things that's been very successful. And then 10% of this, of course, goes into nonprofit community-based victim services. So that ends up being over $4 million because some counties choose to put more than just 10% into that. They put additional justice reinvestment money into that. And the way that it breaks down is about $2.5 million for domestic violence and sexual assault victims, a little over $1 million for child abuse and neglect, and then the remainder go to more general victim services. And all the county lipsticks decide who they want to give that money to, and they have various processes of their own. So some of them do their own kind of application process. I think Multnomah County did that originally. And then some of them have, you know, the smaller counties have fewer options to choose from. All right, this looks mildly terrifying.
Mildly?
Yes, mildly.
That's an understatement.
It's like a circuit board.
It's like art.
It's beautiful.
The last couple of years, we've been getting a lot of people asking us, how is my county spending their justice reinvestment money, or how much of this is going to housing or something like that? So we decided we asked ourselves, what would be the most colorful way we could possibly represent this? And this is what we came up with. Even on your big screen here, this is not kind of the easiest way to view this. It's a lot more suited for your own kind of personal computer. But say you wanted to see what Deschutes County, for instance, is doing, you would mouse over Deschutes County, and it becomes a little less scary. And you can see where Deschutes County is spending their money, how they're breaking all these things up just with their justice reinvestment funds. And then at the bottom there, it also includes the victim services part. So we can see kind of how that breaks down.
Doesn't quite work.
Doesn't work.
Oh, I'm sorry. So these are made into slides. So it's when you look at it on our website, you can.
Oh, on the website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this we just took screenshots because.
Perfect.
Every time I try to go through something on one of these screens, it doesn't work great. So, which I'm sure is my fault, not anyone.
No, it's all good. Thank you.
Yeah. So then if you go back to kind of the starting point, you want to see.
Oh, God, it's crazy.
How much of this is used in services? So that kind of top right corner, that red circle there, what counties are using services and what are they using? You could hover over that, and it goes backwards. So you can kind of look at it from the county perspective, or you can look at it from the services or treatment and work different ways. So hopefully this answers some people's questions when they want to know what specific counties are doing, or you could mouse over just housing right there and see who's funding housing and how much. And then if you want additional information about how exactly that works, or what service provider or how you're buying the housing or renting the housing, you can talk to us and we can put you in touch with the people, or just we have most of those answers at our disposal. So that's kind of the idea. We have this on our website, and so far quite a few people have been using it and finding it useful once they get past the initial fear of all the different colored spaghetti. All right, so Kelly and Mike talked about this quite a bit already, the supplemental $7 million. So this comes from House Bill 3078 in the last big session. And the language from the bill says that these are grant funds for counties for downward departure prison diversion programs. And we know that a big intent from this was the 416 model, which is working very well in Marion County and Lane County, Klamath counties. Other counties they don't call it a 416 necessarily, but they have a very similar structure. And we'll talk a little bit about what that is in a second here. But one of the goals of this, I think, was to be able to spread the money around to multiple counties. We didn't want one county to gobble up all $7 million. And I think that we were successful in that. We tried to build the application process in a way where we thought these would really go to counties where they have people on board that are willing to do the work, because this can, you really have to have people working together, else this won't be effective. So we initially had 13 applications, 13 counties that applied. And because this is not a formula grant, it's a competitive grant, you can apply for as much of the $7 million as you want. So when we took those 13 applications and added it all up, it was a lot more than $7 million. So we had to go back and trim some things out and kind of adjust their expectations. And after much going back and forth and our grant review committee and our commissioners approving this, we ended up with one county that backed out because they said the cuts prevented them from being able to continue with the program. But the other 12 are still in. And so in response to what you were talking about the lawsuit earlier, what I have heard is that every county is hiring. Some counties have already hired people. We did get some questions about that initially. Is this lawsuit going to pull this money away from me, or am I not going to get the second year? But it sounds like everybody's hiring. So this part of 3078 seems to be going forward, and I think people are feeling good about that. So most of these are positions, so they do have to actually go out and hire people. And if they wait you know, 5 or 6 months and do that, we're not going to see the return that we have expected. So I think that's
good news. Haven't you encouraged them to go ahead? And
we have, yeah.
That's good.
So just a little bit more about what we asked for to kind of get to that 416 model. Every county that filled out one of these applications or that filled out an application that was successful had to have a letter of support from their district attorney, their presiding judge, and their community corrections director. And we wanted their DA and their presiding judge to say, we know what this program is, we know what the goals are, we know it's about using less prison on these nonviolent property and drug offenders, or, you know, they could pick their target population. So if they wanted to expand beyond that, that was within their ability to do. And then from community corrections, we wanted to hear, you know, we know we're going to be getting more people on supervision, and we can accommodate that. We're not going to take all these people on supervision and then not have enough treatment beds. We think we have enough to accommodate this. And we also asked the counties to come up with a number for us. Look back at your numbers, see how many people you sent to prison. And in many cases, we ran specific lists for them to see how many people you sent to prison on property and drug crimes in the last couple of years, and how much do you think you can change that? And so they had to give us real numbers. They had to give us letters of support from everybody. We tried to build this as a tight box so that the money will go to counties that really want to do this, because otherwise it's not going to be well spent. We know from the Formula Justice Reinvestment Program being around for a few biennia now that if you don't have kind of everybody on board, it just doesn't work. So we also are going to be asking them to continue to report on this and to monitor their data and monitor their prison use, who gets revoked, who's going to prison right out of the gate, to make sure that they are sticking with what the goals are. We made a spaghetti for this one, too, because that's what we like doing. And so this one is a little simpler because it's only 13 counties, and this is kind of how the money breaks down. So this is on our website as well, and would encourage you to take a look at it. And then if you have any questions about kind of where the money's going or how it fits in, it is directed at positions, because what we've seen be very effective in counties where justice reinvestment is working well is you have to have, for example, a deputy district attorney. You know, there's many ways you can do this, but one thing we've seen be very effective is you have a deputy district attorney that finds these cases as they come in and says, I've looked at this person's criminal history. I think they're a good candidate for a downward departure. They're otherwise going to go to prison. Let's see what parole and probation says they would do with them. And then the judge, the defense attorney, the DDA, and community corrections all kind of come up with a plan for someone. But you really need, you know, you need the luxury of time to be able to do that. And I think that's what this grant allows people to do. These positions are going to be dedicated to looking into these cases and finding people that are appropriate that can be safely supervised in the community, and also kind of getting that buy-in of people that are sitting around and building the plan together. And then ideally they follow the cases, you know, if there are violations, they follow the cases and they know what the plan was when you come back for a probation violation, for instance.
Just a quick question, because when some of us were looking ahead, and looking at, you know, trying to make certain that we were getting, and we knew that the one county that we would not be successful, but I do note that all the other counties that we were hoping that we would be participants are here but one, and I want to know what happened because it's not here, and that's Deschutes County.
Were they the ones that dropped
Deschutes out? My understanding is that Deschutes was very close. I think, you know, this is a quick turnaround for counties because the session ends and then we kind of figure out how much money there is. And this grant didn't exist previously, so this was a brand new thing.
Well, this was kind of like...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know that at the same time, Deschutes County was starting up multiple other programs. And I think that they just didn't quite get together in time and have the agreement to build something, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, probably have a meeting of the mind.
Because as we were looking at the recidivism numbers and looking at, you know, trying to make certain that we were, like I said, knowing the one county that was just absolutely the no, but the others that would make up for that one county, and when we calculated the numbers that we would need, that was one of them. But I am pleased, and I did note what happens when you give judges. So I've got a couple of counties that absolutely got their judges and they're in the mix, so that's good. So that tells me what the strategy has to be next time around, I guess.
Yeah. Well, if you don't have enough judges, it's hard for them to engage in the right way.
Well, Josephine really needed it because...
Well, so did Washington, and we got one there, and we got one Josephine.
Because theirs after giving them the troopers... And they have been limping along in their whole law enforcement community for some time. So that one was that we knew, but and yours too. When I met with Bob Herman, he said he needed a judge. So he got his judge. But we've talked about this before. We've talked about that public safety and that this is a system. It's not like, so if you don't have all parts of the system both working in tandem and that the resources are there to allow them to do their job, you're going to have a problem someplace else in that system. So I get it.
Yep.
I think that's my last slide. Does anybody have any questions about either the grant programs?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, you can.
Thank you. I'd just like to say that I'm so proud of this program and where Ross and Madeline have been able to take it. All of the slides that you've seen are snapshots from our website. And I know some of you know that because you've probably been on our website. But as I travel around, I go across the state, and I walk into rooms and meeting rooms now, and people are on the website, and they know how much prison they used last month. And they know what their recidivism rate was in the last quarter. I mean, that's... I cannot state enough what a dramatic change that is, that people in the community are on, they're looking at real-time data as they're making decisions. And when I get to go out and I speak to my fellow directors nationally, and I'll tell you, running this grant program and having people respond to real data, and when they were applying for these funds, it was, this is how much prison you used last biennium. How is that going to change? How is it going to go up? How is it going to go down? Is your recidivism rates, they've gone up, they've gone down, and having the grantees respond to real data has just been an absolute crucial component of this program. And Ross and Madeline have worked hard, as well as the research team, Courtney, who does our dashboards, and Kelly does our analysis. I mean, just absolutely top-notch work. It's a program that I think you all are very proud of. We certainly are. Our commissioners are very proud of this program. We think that it's one of the most transparent and, efficient grant programs in terms of knowing what you're getting and people being able to make decisions. So I just really want to say to the staff it's a team effort, and everybody who's doing this, it's a really great, great program.
Senator Steiner.
Thank you. I was saying to the chair as you guys were presenting, I don't know another agency that presents data as comprehensively, clearly, and usable in such a usable fashion as you all do. And it's exactly what we're saying. The people of the state should be confident that their tax dollars are going the right ways and that people are being held accountable for how those tax dollars are being spent. That's what y'all are doing. And you're providing a very clear set of expectations and a positive return on investment in terms of the overall well-being of the community, not to mention the economic benefits. So I think it's pretty cool. Nicely done, everybody.
Yeah. With or without the spaghetti art.
Exactly. I like the spaghetti art.
I do, too.
Yeah. Well, it does make from making policy decisions a lot easier and making budgetary decisions.
No hand waving.
Yes, it does, because, having the previous session and making those decisions, and now it's the decisions that were made and the dollars that were allocated, what has happened with those dollars. And so I really appreciate you and the staff and the work that's being done, not only on the justice reinvestment, but the work that you've done on the whole issue of alcohol and drug as well. That was turned around rather quickly. I know how complicated it is in order to get everyone and to collect data and get all those agreements from the various entities. So I really thank you and look forward to clearly the results that say that the policy that we actually implemented, that we are on the right track, and that the dollars that we actually allocated are also, that we're getting the return on the investment. that we need. And having said that, and we've got a very short period of time, we'll be ending. At some point, I hope that I will have you back so that we will talk about Norway and some plans that are in the making with respect to Norway.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I really want to hear more about that.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So with that, Ms. Nabarka, do we have anything else on in the agenda?
Madam Co-Chair, committee members, we don't have anything else for today. On Wednesday, we will hear from the Department of Corrections, from the Military Department, and from the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision.
Okay. And if, since there's nothing further, we are adjourned.